Hello and Merry Christmas. Welcome to a brand new episode of the Scared to Nuts podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Over the course of this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite people about their musical passions past and present. These include people who have DJed our club night, as well as those who have created our film nights. Today, on this special Christmas episode, I'm delighted to be joined by the singer-songwriter Billy Martin. Billy has been writing and recording music since her early teens, weaving introspective lyrics with folk melodies and gentle honesty. Her latest album, Dog-Eared, offers a wider landscape and was one of my favourite albums of the year. I'll be talking to her about her songwriting process, the music that moves her, and how to navigate the music industry today. Hi, Billy, and welcome to the show. So I last saw you when you played a really great guest DJ set at the club, along with Will Taylor from Flight at Scared to Dance. How was that for you?
I'd love to ask you how you found that. It was wonderfully chaotic. Everything I had planned did not happen. I had a whole set. I had three practice DJ sessions. It was all ready to go. I was key matching and tempo matching. And then I got there and my USB didn't work. So I think we did a sort of jamboree mix of actual CDs and Spotify mixing.
I think Will kind of took the reins while we tried to set up your USB stick.
He certainly took over, yeah.
And then we sort of tag teamed when we got your USB stick working.
Yeah.
And there was
a
lot of post-punk on there.
Which surprised you?
It did a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot.
Well, I thought you would quite like that.
Well, I did.
So you got to know your audience.
So how meticulous were you with the planning? It sounds like you put a lot of thought into it.
Yeah, I got really stressed about it. I think there's something within me that wants to, you know, inherently people please. I guess that's part of being an entertainer. And I love doing it with all my heart, and I've grew up doing it. And I put a lot of weight onto it. And there's so much fear in terms of what each individual in the room wants to hear next. And I really enjoy trying to figure that out. It's very much a group process and me sort of feeding off of this human experiment that is a DJ club night.
Yeah, I always find it quite interesting when guests come with sort of a perfect plan and then you have to react to the room because you're sort of constantly toying with, like I said, playing what you want to play.
Yeah.
But also people pleasing. So that's always quite a delicate balance, I think.
Mm-hmm. And how ironic you want to go with it as well, which is sort of a new modern layer of DJing.
Yeah, I have noticed that with some guest DJ sets.
I bet you have.
And we were introduced by Simon Armitage. How did you get to know Simon?
Lovely Simon. Lovely poet laureate Simon.
Yeah.
How do I know Simon? I know Simon two ways, through his group LYR.
Yep.
And then also through a very good friend of mine, Guy Garvey, who is also best friends with Simon.
Mm.
So we just sort of became an unassuming crew. And there was a summer a couple of years ago where me plus Will plus Simon were all booked for the same stage at the same festival every weekend.
Oh, really?
So we just bump into each other then. And it's funny when the poet laureate asks you for tips. Very extraordinary.
It was very strange for me getting to know him because I studied him at GCSE.
Me too.
And I got into his poetry through that. And then when Scared to Dance started in 2009, and we started to get guest DJs. Simon came on board quite early on. I think it was 2011. And he was hosting a music/technology show on BBC Four. And he was in Japan and he was going through his vinyl records. And I was going, God, these are all the records that we play at the club. So I somehow got in contact with him. And that's how we ended up DJing at Scared to Dance. And
how beautiful.
Yeah. And he's continued ever since, bless him.
And what was his first set like?
That is a very good question. Let me have a look. I probably have it in the archive A lot of 80s indie, I think, as you would expect. I DJ'd at both his 50th and his 60th birthdays. And yeah, it was definitely leaning into kind of The Smiths, The Cure, definitely The Fall, Depeche Mode, Ben and Sebastian. But then Simon likes kind of sort of funkier stuff as well, like Sly and the Family Stone and things like that. So yeah, lovely guy. Anyway, I want to talk to you about your new album, Dog-Eared, which is one of my favourite releases of the year. When did you start working on those sets of songs?
When did I start working on that? Let's say 18 months ago. The process was incredibly quick from having all the songs to having a finished album. So for that reason, it feels like, you know, I did it a couple of months ago. But I recorded it in July last year in Brooklyn with my good friend Phil Weinrobe, who's the most excellent producer. He's actually just put out a mix with the masters session. For anyone listening, they should probably listen to that. But as is always the case with me, I tend to just subliminally write. And that will probably be as a result of a huge drought. I love to write in winter. For some reason, all my voice notes are in January every year. I think there's something about hibernating and feeling like you must create and you must get something out. Not so good at that in the summer months. Yeah, so I sort of was continuously writing these songs. Partway through that process, Phil and I had a call, decided we wanted to do the record together. And then he sort of jumped on board as a kind of writing sort of professor. He was very adamant that I was going to write a lot more than I usually do. And I was going to be able to write stuff that wasn't good. And he was sort of vehemently checking in with me every single day, asking for a song. And then the rule, one of the many rules, but a rule was that as soon as I'd written the song, I had to immediately send it to him, as soon as I'd stopped recording, I guess. So it was an intense process, but one that really worked and allowed me to look at songwriting in a more objective way, which I think is helpful for artists sometimes. I was much less in my head about it, and I knew that there was an audience from the beginning, as in his voice, his ear. So it took away a lot of kind of existential fear and all that rubbish.
So was there an emotional or thematic core when you were writing these songs?
There are varying tones here. There's certainly a level of frustration I think I was feeling, a sort of angst, the source of which I couldn't find. So a lot of the songs discuss that. I mean, a writer should never write about the industry that they're writing in, but a lot of it was getting my head around how modern music works and how difficult it is to exist in there, and how many of us there are, and also, you know, how little sources of inspiration there are. I think I was really trying to get to grips with that. And then a lot of it is about finding self and finding your true identity, whatever that may be, and discovering that that in fact changes on a day-to-day basis or changes without you noticing over 5 years. What we become from childhood versus what we expected to become. A lot of those thoughts. I could keep going, but, you know, let's not.
No, I think it's interesting. I mean, how much did that differ from your previous album in terms of the lyrical content? It sounds like there's a lot of frustration and angst there.
I think in the beginning, I felt a lot of isolation. I grew up in North Yorkshire, and there certainly wasn't a music scene anywhere. So music for me was a familial kind of love and then artists themselves that I felt like I knew. You know, I felt I knew Elliot Smith. I felt I knew Nick Drake. I felt I knew Joni. It was very much an escapist joy. So maybe a hint of angst there in terms of resentment for my hometown, whilst also similarly writing about how much I love the natural world and how much I, as all Yorkshire people do, we have this immense sense of pride that's just intrinsic within us. But yeah, in the beginning, everything was just sort of happening to me very quickly. And I guess I was writing about the confusion and loss of self with that. And there was kind of an overwhelming melancholia that felt really comfortable at the time. And as I've grown on and moved on, I'd say the last two albums are probably where I wanted to be. That's kind of the tone that I wanted to set the whole time, but I just didn't have the experience to do so.
And how do you navigate that line between vulnerability and even privacy when writing such personal songs?
I struggle with it. Yeah, I never know how much to reveal. I'm a private person who has to share a lot by force. And I am understanding that the lyrics that people gravitate towards are ultimately the most terrifying, the most personal, the most kind of ugly. And I certainly gravitate to songs that do that as well. So I suppose all the best things in the world are quite hard to do. It's harder to be selfless than it is selfish. It's harder to make the right decision in general. So within writing, not taking the easy way out is a good thing to remember.
I think one of the standout songs on the album is Feeling. Could you talk to us about the process behind the opening track? You know, what was happening when you wrote that song?
When I was writing that song, I was having really insanely visceral memories of being a really, really young child, so like below five, definitely. And I had this strong memory of being at my grandparents' house, my dad's parents, and they grew up in a place called Cosby in Leicester, in a council estate. And I remember going there sort of once a year or something and being given this box of toys that came from my dad's upbringing and also my grandparents. So it's sort of an ancient, musty box of weird treats. And I used to just sit there and sort of not really know where I was. Anyway, my grandma had this amazing elaborate carpet, sort of tapestry type thing. Well, the carpet that every grandma has in every house. And I found it really satisfying to play with the toy cars and sort of follow the patterns in the rug and like they were roads. Anyway, I just had a really strong memory of that. And the first verse kind of fell out of that. And that song's a lot about childhood and kind of that warmth that we might feel towards our past selves and how we can still take that with us, I guess.
And how do you feel digging that deep? I mean, I would struggle to remember that early. My memory is terrible. Back to, you know, the age of five or earlier. It feels like that must take quite a lot out of you to dig that far down.
You would think. I mean, I'm certainly not digging towards the more traumatic aspects. I think I have like a fondness for memories like that. So they do sort of just pop in sort of daily. I've actually started writing them all down so I can start to piece together what it all means. But no, I have a weirdly good long-term memory. I remember things that people have said to me 6 years ago. You know, if my brother tells me a story, I'll say, Max, you told me this 11 years ago, etc. I think that's what comes with kind of having to access your mind in order to make something and choosing which sort of pockets to open.
And you say you're writing these down. Is that for yourself or is that for future lyrical content or something else or, you know, even, you know, just writing?
Oh, that's just something I feel like we should do. I know a few people that have either done or are doing dream therapy or they're with a therapist that asks them to wake up at 4 in the morning and immediately write down their dreams. So it's a version of that, I guess. It's kind of like the subconscious sort of demanding to be heard.
And I also want to talk to you about the track Leap Year, which I think is a real kind of center point of the album. What was the inspiration behind that song?
Well, that was the inspiration had nothing to do with me, because at that point of making the album, I was very much sick of myself. So I was here, I was at home, and most of it was written on this table. But this one, I was having a sick day. I had a really bad cold, and I had a low voice, and it was Phoebe from Friends with Sticky Shoes. And I was playing around on my phone on this thing called an iOptagon, which is an iPhone version of an Optagon.
Okay.
And it's got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of old samples on there from any genre you wish. And I found one called Folk and Other Moods, which I really liked. And essentially you just play around on it. And in doing so, I found this really classical chord structure that I never would have done on the guitar or piano, because you're just sort of pressing buttons. And I remember that sticking, and it sounded like, I hate when people say this, but the song really was writing itself because of how kind of like, I mean, I'm sure it's a version of songs that have been written a million times over. It's very much not a unique song structurally, melodically. But to me, it sort of felt like, yeah, a song that was sort of already there, and I was just marking it through. Anyway, I was writing that, and then I looked at the date, and the date was February. When is the leap year? February 29th. Perfect. And then I had my title.
And are there any other songs on the album that kind of surprised you as well? I mean, that sounds like quite a surprising process for you, rather than, you know, sitting down at your desk with a set of lyrics or a melody or whatever. You know, were there any others that sort of came in that way?
Clover was surprising to me because that came out of a friend of mine just staying over for the night, and we were talking, and then both picked up guitars, and that sort of happened. His name is Willie J. Healy. You should get him to DJ. You know, that song to me is very conversational, as if we were just talking to each other, and not so good with collaboration. I tend to not like it or not do a very good job. So I have fond memories of that one. They were all written in slightly different ways. I mean, Planets was written in a hotel room in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That came out of nowhere. And it was sort of, yeah, a sporadic year of things like that.
So how would you describe the evolution of the sound of this new album, Dog-Eared, compared to your previous album, Drop Cherries? Was it more of a collaborative process with the producer, Phil Weinrobe?
They're all collaborative. I think there's been more of a spotlight on this one because I wasn't co-producing. I wasn't making the decisions. I couldn't hear my own voice. I couldn't hear anything. So sort of playing blindly, which then opened us up to this new form of live sound. But I must say, sometimes people think that, I mean, it's very common for music to be recorded live nowadays. It's really not out of the ordinary, and certainly was how it always was. So that's kind of a given. And Drop Cherries was like that. But there was a little bit of separation, i.e. I was in a booth, or there were certain overdubs, or we moved studios for a bit, or things like that. Whereas this sound that came from Dog-Eared was, I never left my chair, and nobody left their spot. And we walk in, put our phones in the bin, and then get into this room, and then we'd leave as it got dark. And I think sonically it meant for a more kind of conducive together sound. You know, I wanted an album that was going to sound like one long song, essentially, without being boring. And I think we managed that. I think there's so many personalities on this record that they all sort of have their moment to shine through, and I really enjoy listening to that.
So did that feel more like being in a band to you?
Yes, which is what I've always wanted to do. I just didn't have anyone growing up to do that with. So I had to be a solo artist. And I realized that this whole time, I just wanted to be a guitarist. One day, I will do that. It's never too late. To be at the back of the stage would be, oh, beautiful.
Well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, where do you think that feeling comes from? Are you kind of, is it the pressure of leading the whole thing, in both in terms of songwriting and performing, and not even mentioning all the other things you have to do being a musician now, you know, social media and interviews?
Yeah, love those. Yeah, imagine being the band member that is filmed with the mic but just doesn't say anything. God, that'd be awesome. I think it's more like the sort of mental relief I would feel not to have your every movement or word analysed. And I wanted to say scrutinised, but nobody's scrutinising. Or some people are. But it's what your head decides for you, which is that you have to win people over. And I learned a couple of years ago that that's not the case, and people buy a ticket because they want to be there, not because they've been dragged. And it's up to you to make the show that you want to make. But there's a beautiful thing about being in a band, and I really got a taste of that during this album.
Are there any musicians you'd love to work with?
Many.
Are they contemporaries or?
Well, the Bell and Sebastian guys, that would be awesome.
I can speak to Stuart.
Perfect. Let's get that done. There are all sorts. I mean, what sort of band do I want to be in? I suppose, like everyone, I want to be in the Talking Heads. In fact, she was my screensaver for a long time.
You recorded the album at Sugar Mountain Studio, New York. How much fun was that? Was that because Phil was already there? Is that his studio? And had you recorded there before?
That's his studio. I had maybe 3 days there the September before we recorded. It's now no longer there, his house. So he built the studio in his basement and then sort of gave it a website. And because he built it, everything was to his level and his spec. And it's not like walking into, you know, a world-renowned studio that's actually a piece of shit and no cable works and the desk, only 4 buttons on the desk are there, but it looks great. So everything was very smooth and very beautiful. And he certainly was living a dream life. He's actually just sold that place and has moved upstate into the Catskills and Woodstock, which is where all the fancy people are moving nowadays. I suppose it's like us all moving to Margate, but it's not Margate. Anyway, so the next album is looking like it will be up there.
Oh, you'd love to work with him again?
Yeah.
You clearly enjoyed the process of him setting parameters for you.
Yes. Part of the reason it's called Dog-Eared is because there was supposed to be a part 2, which I never wrote. As I said, the process was so short, I think we only ended up tracking the whole thing in 6 or 7 days. And it was like a ride that we didn't want to get off. And we were talking about it like it was the start of a project.
And are there any songs written for that, or is it the case of
no?
So nothing left over.
Oh, there are leftovers, but I like to start fresh.
Yeah, wait for your January batch of songs to come in.
Exactly. Yeah, not long now.
So you mentioned earlier your frustration with the music industry. So going back further in your career, you started writing music when you were very young and you were, I guess, sort of discovered on YouTube from covering songs. What drew you to music at such a young age and the need to sort of put them out into the world?
What drew me to it was my family. My dad taught me guitar. Mum was playing piano. My brother played guitar. We all sang together. Not in that kind of mamas and papas way, in like, a casual private way.
Were they folk musicians? Did they play in clubs or anything?
So nobody in the family had ever played professionally. So I was the first one that kind of took it too far. And yeah, the YouTube thing was accidental. We also did not understand the scope of that website. So at the time, it was genuinely just so my grandparents could watch a video. They lived in France at the time and had the internet. So it was a very unassuming thing. I didn't know that being a musician was a career necessarily. I was confused as to how that could be a job. And I was, you know, well, in the beginning I was 12, and then I got sort of scouted at 14, and then I signed to Sony at 15. So it very much happened to me, but not without my consent.
And how was that for you entering the music industry at such a young age? I mean, that's a very young age to be...
doing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't comprehend that at all.
What were you doing at 14?
I was at school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was reading Simon Armitage poetry.
Right. Yeah, me too. I was also at school, and I also made sure to finish it, and I did my GCSEs and I did my A levels, and I went on tour, but I took my revision, and it was a half life, a secret life. I kept it quite low key at home, and would disappear from school a few times a week and go down to London, talk on the radio, and come back. But I don't know. I kind of blocked out a lot of that time because you think you're much older than you are at the time. But I feel very distant from it now. It's, you know, like all of our origin stories or what we do as teenagers, it's kind of like a distant memory of idiocy.
And how did you consider doing anything else other than music? Or was it a case that this came along just so early that that was the only track that you were going to be on?
Yeah, I guess I never really had the opportunity to discover anything else. You know, I never went for apprenticeships. So I never was interning. I knew that it was going to be books or music. I always wanted to be a music supervisor, still do. If anyone can hire me, I am here. Yeah, there was no part of me that wasn't going to be somewhere connected to music.
So how do you look back on that part of your career? You said you sort of tried to almost block it out, as most of us do in our awkward teenage years. Do you find it more helpful with distance, or do you try not to be too reflective?
I think one day I'll do a big write-up about it. But no, I think distance is great. It's just not a part of me that I find very interesting. You know, it's like I just... tried things musically, and they were public, and that's kind of it, really. And I was discovering myself.
Is there any advice you'd give to people, you know, young artists who are starting off? Is there anything you'd be able to pass on?
Well, I think I get asked this a lot, and I never really provide a good answer, and it makes me think that I should really prep this one. Everybody says trust your gut, but I didn't think that's a very good thing to say, because your gut can lie to you on a daily basis. I don't think we know what that means. I would say find your people first and kind of expand your circle, so you're always surrounded by good people that kind of inspire you and, you know, love you before you... go out on your own. I think I certainly was lacking a kind of community, and I would have felt a lot more self-assured, and there would have been a lot more discussion that wasn't internal around things like first gigs, first radios, first albums, all the firsts. I think if I had my mates with me at the time, it would have been a bit sweeter. I'm painting myself as such a lonely, lonely girl. But it's true. I think the music industry can be really lonely, and it's your name on the contract versus a plethora of other people. So yeah, I'd say expand your musical creative circle, or even wider than that. You know, make friends with painters, make friends with directors, make friends with designers. Like, go and find that scene.
So what were those early inspirations for you? You know, what did you listen to growing up in the house? You know, were you digging into your parents' record collection or was it your brother's?
Bit of both. Yeah, I guess my brother brought in the kind of the 90s American grunge. You know, the Nirvana, the Blink 182. What else was he listening to? Radiohead was a big one from him, but also our family love. Very much what my parents were listening to. There was a no nursery rhyme rule. So I grew up on Hunky Dory, which will remain my favourite album, I think, because of that. Talking Heads, Joni, Kate Bush. Dad sort of had this, he had the prog down and the rock down and, you know, quickly taught me about seminal bands like, this is Pink Floyd, this is who's in Pink Floyd, this is the Who, this is Who Died. This is, you know, like, sit me down in front of the Top of the Pops and Jules Holland and sort of educate me on things. And then mum was born slightly later, so she was very much an 80s kid and was a huge punk, you know, shaved her hair off, bleach, buzz cut, escaped out the window to go see punk gigs in Bradford. She was more sort of, well, she had Kate Bush and Joni, but it was Susie and the Banshees and X-Ray Specs and Psychedelic Furs and people like that. Yeah, so I suppose the angst came from her.
And can you remember the first album that you bought, you know, with your pocket money?
It was something really shameful. It was definitely like a top 40 Now Music CD and it had the Sugar Babes on it.
I used to live on those Now compilations. Me and my sister, who's 4 years older than me, that was our musical education. Top of the Pops and Now compilations. It was the cheapest way of getting as much music as possible.
Yeah, I do remember being really fond of Lily Allen's All Right Still. This is what I got in my youth. You know, I missed all the good stuff. Not to say Lily Allen's, but you know what I mean. That was kind of the most left field thing you could go for at the time. But I certainly did a lot of avoiding the era I was brought up in and sort of escaping pop music over that time. But also thinking about my DJ sets, it's definitely in there.
It is, yes. You say you were sort of avoiding music of the time. Was that when your career was starting to take off or?
Oh, that was a dark period, wasn't it? Sort of 2012 to 2015.
Not great. Early 2000s is not the best period.
Early 2000s, I would take over mid-2000s indie pop bands. Yeah, I'd take that. Not a lot of room for women at that time as well.
No, you look back at the indie sleaze period and you're like, oh, they forgot to invite any women.
Not one woman there. That's fine.
The long blondes were great, but... yeah, in a minority.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So do you remember, just going back to your earlier career, do you remember a moment where you thought things had clicked and you were getting more of a sort of handle on how you wanted things to be in terms of your songwriting, your albums? Or did you feel a bit more swayed by being on a big label?
Certainly not swayed. I just remember feeling like I shouldn't have really ever signed to such a machine. You know, I was very adamant from the start that I wasn't going to make music that was going to make them money, and they knew that, and they wanted to work with me anyway. So there was kind of a weird understanding that that's what was going to happen, i.e. nothing. Yeah, I'm totally fine with that. I've always said I wanted to be quietly happy, and here we are.
Yeah. So there's a lot more contentment now, it feels like.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think it's really important for anybody to shed the stuff that was out of their control or you know, came from a point of innocence or lack of living. I think we should all kind of cut ourselves a bit more grace, and there is no point dwelling.
So who have you seen play this summer purely for joy?
purely for joy. I mean, I was there at All Points East for the indiest of all indie days with Maccabees, good friends, and Bombay, who actually asked me to stage dive, and I was all there outside of stage ready to go. And then their manager said no.
Oh no.
Yeah. And then the boys were like, what happened? You chickened out.
What did the manager say?
He just flat out was like, no, don't think you're going to do that. He was absolutely right.
And who else have you seen play this summer?
Who else have I seen? I was at Glastonbury. I was there. I had only been once, and that was last year. And we played, and that was marvellous. And then we played again this year. And I was actually playing just before George Harrison's son, Darnie, which was weird. And all of a sudden, all these Range Rovers started pulling up behind the tent. And this was just after we played. So I thought, oh my God, I've made some ripples. And then quickly realised that McCartney was just there to see. Yes. So he was there. Stella was there. Simon Pegg was there, which was weird. Judd Apatow was there. Leslie Mann was there. All to see little Darnie.
Did you get to have a chat with any of them?
I actually was doing merch after the show and turned around and Judd was there. And for some reason, this crazy confidence came over me and I just shouted, Judd! Never met this man in my life. He didn't hear me. One day. No, but actual music that I saw. I saw Beth Gibbons. She was amazing.
Yeah.
Have you seen her live show?
I haven't.
Very expensive and clever.
How was it expensive?
In terms of caliber of players on there and amount of players and design, sound design, some weird sort of soundscape setups, stuff that you would not think you could take to Glastonbury.
Would that be something that you would want in the future?
A soundscape? Sure.
Budgets pending?
Budget pending. Yeah, I'll take it all.
Well, how was playing Glastonbury? I did see you on the BBC coverage playing acoustically.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, how was that?
It was great. It's very hectic doing those things. I don't think anyone ever has a chill time at Glastonbury. I have a great love for the year before because obviously that was the first time and felt very special. And I didn't know if anyone was going to turn up. And there they were in our little tent. Very beautiful. This time was different. I had a lot of sound issues, actually, so had a pretty rubbish time on stage. But I made sure not to think about that too much and kind of realise where I was.
So was Glastonbury the previous year, was that a career highlight or previous aspiration for you?
I don't know about aspiration. I didn't really have any aspirations because I didn't know what those could be. You know, I didn't have a venue that I always wanted to play. I wasn't even aware of venues, apart from the Brudenell. That was it for me. Yeah, there was no sort of five-year plan or anything, but Glastonbury's definitely up there. Very pleased to have been there.
How do you find playing festivals compared to playing your own tours? Are they much more stressful experiences because you don't get proper sound checks and so on?
Yeah, all of that stuff, all of the road dog stuff, I suppose lack of control and lack of how that gig is going to sound is stressful. I think everybody prefers their own tours because there is a familiarity there. You see the same people every day. You get into this rhythm. It is more about survival than it is kind of like enjoyment. You know, you've got to be aware of the longevity and how many times you got to sing and play and how much sleep you need. But I'm enjoying it more and more.
How do you find managing that?
It's really difficult. What I don't like about touring is that artists have to sort of return to their child selves, which is coming back to the album. You know, we need to be fed, we need to be watered, we need to know where to sleep, we need to know when to sleep, we need to know when to wake up, we need to know where to go and where's the address, we can't book Ubers for ourselves and blah, blah, blah. It's, it's incredibly frustrating. Sometimes you just want to, like, not Google where to go for dinner or walk down the street by yourself. That's what I'm learning. I'm learning that I need at least an hour or two a day where I'm completely alone.
Yeah.
And that's quite rare to find on tour. So fingers crossed for this one. Let you know how that goes. Yeah, I don't think touring is a normal human experience, and I don't think it should be normalised. And I think if you're not careful, you could go and tour forever. And I know lots of crew members that have accidentally done that and then lost their lives. So yeah, got to be careful, but it's wonderful to travel the world.
And I just want to end on one thing that I read in a previous interview that you gave, where you said you shouldn't meet your heroes.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been told by Jeremy Deller that you should definitely meet your heroes.
Well, depends who your heroes are.
So what led to that statement?
Well, here's a good example. Being that close to Paul McCartney the other day and deciding that he was an untouchable gift, my partner Will actually did go in for the handshake and thank you so much for being Paul McCartney. And they did have a moment. And I'd never seen him so upset after that in his life. He was distraught because it's never the thing that you want it to be.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, I think you want, because he really is his ultimate hero. And there's no words that can really, you sort of want to give them a USB stick of your entire life, just pop it into them for a second so they can see how much it's affected you and what's happened. And then they can take it back and be like, I understand, thank you for listening. But ultimately, if they are your heroes and they are heroes, they're used to it. They're used to hearing that stuff. And therefore you become, you know, another on the pile, the deluge of adoring fans. And I miss mystery and I miss autonomy between artist and fan.
I think in terms of the people that I've met or been lucky to work with, I've had overwhelmingly positive experiences. I can not really think of too many examples that have been disappointing. But I think what I find useful is having a distance there where maybe people will know what the music has meant to you as a fan, but there is still sort of a healthy and mutual respect there. And I wonder if that's the little gap that you have to find sometimes with people. Because I mean, like you said, people get told how brilliant they are and how much their music means to people all the time. So you need, I mean, this is the problem with social media, that you can now contact people or leave comments and people see them, and that's difficult to navigate. Is that something that you've found in your career as you've got bigger and made more albums?
Oh yeah, I hate it. I loathe it. I wish we could all have Nokias. And maybe one day we will. I'm kind of feeling a sort of aversion from everybody slightly in that social media actually makes us very sad. I think my relationship with myself would be a lot better had I not, you know, arrived at the digital age. I think music would be way better because we could all stop listening to each other and just make our own stuff. However, it is really important, and the, you know, breadths and stretches that one can reach in terms of musical distance is quite astonishing. And I do get lovely notes and stories and letters from people, and that does, you know, that rocks my world. But I think these things should be taken with a bucket of salt and sort of entered into with a light foot. Because it is Mordor.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I hope we're going to reach a breaking point with social media. I mean, we've seen certain platforms collapse. I mean, Facebook has pretty much collapsed for most generations. And now I guess we're more of the Instagram generation or TikTok. I hope that at some point it comes to a head, because I'm not sure it's very good for everyone's mental health with making unhelpful comparisons.
But things like Scared to Dance, you know, none of those, well, I'm sure many people would still be there, but that is, you know, it's the megaphone. It's a call to arms. And it is allowing people to go and do something that's real with humans, that's momentary and present. And I think that's how we should be using it, is kind of like do you want to come to this super cool and interesting thing where someone's made a beautiful thing? Great. Yes or no. And then get off.
Well, that human interaction has always been very important to me. I mean, during the pandemic, Scared to Dance didn't happen for 15 months for obvious reasons. And I was asked by various people to, you know, would I DJ online so people could experience in that way? And I didn't want to do it. And the reason was, reflecting on it, was that the huge enjoyment that I get from Scared to Dance is the human interaction of the fact that you're in a room with other people. They're not looking at their phones because they're interacting with each other, or they're interacting to the music. Hopefully we're playing things that people like, as well as sneaking in a few things for ourselves. But that's a huge thing for me. And that's the same with the film night Q&As that we do now, where we invite guests. I enjoy talking to people, or I enjoy making them dance. You know, I think that's a huge part. So yeah. So social media is a way of getting people to those, hopefully, more enjoyable social environments rather than us being in our little silos on our mobile phones.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's our modern church.
Hopefully. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Billy. And we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks to Billy Martin for joining me, sharing her music, her process, and a glimpse into the spaces that inspire her. Billy will be guest DJing at the Scared to Dance Club Night on Saturday the 10th of January at the Victoria Dalston. There aren't too many tickets left, so be quick and get yours from Dice. We also have our upcoming New Year's Eve Club Night, which is very close to selling out. I'll be back on New Year's Day when our guest is James Dean Bradfield from Manic Street Preachers. He discusses Escape from History, the documentary film about the making of the band's acclaimed album Everything Must Go, charting the band's rise following the disappearance of their bandmate Richie Edwards. This podcast was produced at Third Floor Recording.